Reading chapter 15 of the autobiography of a yogi, Cauliflower Robert. Master, a gift for you. Six huge cauliflowers were planted with my hands. I watched over their growth with tender care of a mother nursing her child. I presented the basket of vegetables with a ceremonial flourish. Thank you, Sri Yukteswar's smile was warm with appreciation. Please keep them in your room. I shall need them tomorrow for a special dinner. I've just arrived in Puri to spend my college summer vacation with my guru at his seaside hermitage. Built by Master and his disciples, the cheerful little two-story retreat fronts on the Bay of Bengal. I awoke early the following morning, refreshed by the salty sea breezes and the charm of my surroundings. Sri Yukteswar's melodious voice was calling. I took a look at my cherished cauliflowers and stowed them neatly under my bed. Come, let us go to the beach. Master led the way. Several young disciples and myself followed in a scattered group. Our guru surveyed us with mild criticism. When our Western brothers walk, they usually take pride in unison. Now, please, in two rows, keep rhythmic step with one another. Sri Yukteswar watched as we obeyed and began singing, boys go to and fro in a pretty little row. I could not but admire the ease with which Master was able to match the brisk pace of his young students. Halt! My guru's eyes sought mine. Did you remember to lock the back door of the hermitage? I don't think so, sir. Sri Yukteswar was silent for a few minutes, a half-suppressed smile on his lips. No, you forgot, he said finally. Divine contemplation must not make you make a bad excuse for material carelessness. You have neglected your duty in safeguarding the ashram. You must be punished. I thought he was obscurely joking when he added, your six cauliflowers will soon only be five. He turned around at Master's orders and marched back until we were close to the hermitage. Rest a while. Mukunda, look across the compound on our left. Observe the road beyond. A certain man will arrive there presently. He will be the means of your chastisement. Instead, I concealed my vexation at these incomprehensible remarks. A peasant soon appeared on the road. He was dancing grotesquely and flinging his arms about with meaningless gestures. Almost paralyzed with curiosity, I glued my eyes on the hilarious spectacle. As the man reached a point in the road where he would vanish from our view, Sri Yukteswar said, now he will return. The peasant at once changed his direction and made for the rear of the ashram. Crossing a sandy track, he entered the building by the back door. I had left it unlocked, even as my guru had said. The man emerged shortly, holding one of my prized cauliflowers. He now strode along respectfully, invested with the dignity of possession. The unfolding farce in which my role appeared to be the bewildered victim was not so disconcerting that I failed in indignant pursuit. I was halfway to the road when Master recalled me. He was shaking from head to foot with laughter. That poor, crazy man has been longing for a cauliflower, he explained between outbursts of mirth. I thought it would be a good idea if he got one of yours, so ill-guarded. I dashed to my room, where I found that the thief, evidently one with a vegetable fixation, had left untouched my gold rings, watch, and money, all lying openly on the blanket. He had crawled instead under the bed, where, completely hidden from casual sight, one of my cauliflowers had aroused his single-hearted desire. I asked Sri Yukteswar that evening to explain the incident, which I thought had a few baffling features. My guru shook his head slowly. You will understand it someday. Science will soon discover a few of these hidden laws. When the wonders of radio burst some years later on the astounded world, I remember Master's prediction. Age-old concepts of time and space were annihilated. Oh, peasant's home so narrow that London or Calcutta could not enter. The dullest intelligence enlarged before the indisputable proof of one aspect of man's omnipresence. The plot of the cauliflower comedy can be best understood by a radio analogy. Chuyutishwar was a perfect human radio. Thoughts are no more than very gentle vibrations moving in the ether. Just as a sensitized radio picks up a desired musical number out of thousands of other programs from every direction, so my guru had been able to catch the thought of the half-witted man who hankered for a cauliflower out of the countless thoughts of broadcasting human wills in the world. By his powerful will, Master was also a human broadcasting station and had successfully directed the peasant to reverse his steps and go to a certain room for a single cauliflower. Intuition is soul guidance, appearing naturally in man during those instants when his mind is calm. Nearly everyone has had the experience of an inexplicable correct hunch or has transferred his thoughts effectively to another person. Human mind, free from the static of restlessness, can perform through its antenna of intuition all the functions of complicated radio mechanisms, sending and receiving thoughts, tuning out undesirable ones. As the power of the radio depends on the amount of electrical current it can utilize, so the human radio is energized according to the power of will possessed by each individual. All thoughts vibrate eternally in the cosmos. By deep concentration, a master is able to detect the thoughts of any mind, living or dead. Thoughts are universally and not individually rooted. A truth cannot be created, but only perceived. The erroneous thoughts of man result from imperfections in his discernment. The goal of yoga science is to calm the mind, that without distortion it may mirror the divine vision in the universe. The goal of yoga science is to calm the mind, that without distortion, it may mirror the divine vision in the universe. Radio and television have brought the instantaneous sound and sight of remote persons to the firesides of millions. The first faint scientific intimations that man is an all-pervading spirit, not a body confined to a point in space, but the vast soul, which the ego is in most barbaric modes, conspires in vain to cramp. Very strange, very wonderful, seemingly very improbable phenomenon may yet appear, which, when once established, will not astonish us more than when we are now astonished at all that science has taught us during the last century. Charles Robert Bechet, Nobel Prizeman in Physiology, has declared. He goes on, quoting, "It is assumed that the phenomena which we now accept without surprise do not excite our astonishment because they are understood. But this is not the case. If they do not surprise us, it is not because they are understood. It is because they are familiar. For if that which is not understood ought to surprise us, we should be surprised at everything. The fall of a stone thrown into the air, the acorn which becomes an oak, mercury which expands when it is heated, iron attracted by a magnet, phosphorus which burns when it is rubbed. The science of today is a light matter. The revolutions and evolutions which we'll experience in 100,000 years will far exceed the most daring anticipations. The truths, those surprising, amazing, unforeseen truths, which our descendants will discover, are even now all around us, staring us in the eye, so to speak. And yet, we do not see them. But it is not enough to say that we do not see them. We do not wish to see them. For as soon as an unexpected and unfamiliar fact appears, we try to fit it into the framework of the commonplaces of acquired knowledge. And we are indignant that anyone should dare to experiment further. Close quote. A humorous occurrence took place a few days after I had been so implausibly robbed of cauliflower. A certain kerosene lamp could not be found. Having so lately witnessed my guru's omniscient insight, I thought I would demonstrate, he would demonstrate it, that it was child's play to locate the lamp. Master perceived my expectation. With exaggerated gravity, he questioned all the ashram residents. A young disciple confessed that he had used the lamp to go to the well in the backyard. Sri Yukteswar gave the solemn counsel, seek the lamp, seek the lamp near the well. I rushed there, no lamp. Crestfallen, I returned to my guru. He is now laughing heartily, without compunction for my disillusionment. Too bad I couldn't direct you to the vanished lamp. I am not a fortune teller. With twinkling eyes, he added, I'm not even a satisfactory Sherlock Holmes. I realized that Master would never display his powers when challenged or for a triviality. Delightful weeks sped by. Sri Yukteswar was planning a religious procession. He asked me to lead the disciples over the town and beach of Puri. The festive day dawned as one of the hottest of the summer. Guruji, how can I take the barefooted students over the fiery sands? I spoke despairingly. I will tell you a secret, Master responded. The Lord will send an umbrella of clouds, and you shall all walk in comfort. I happily organized the procession. Our group started from the ashram with a satsang banner. Designed by Sri Yukteswar, it bore the symbol of the single eye, the telescopic gaze of intuition. No sooner had we left the hermitage than part of the sky which was overhead became filled with clouds as though by magic. To the accompaniment of astonished ejaculations from all sides, a very light shower fell, cooling the city streets and the burning seashore. The soothing drops descended during the 2 hours of the parade, the exact instant at which our group returned to the ashram. The clouds and rain passed away tracelessly. You see how God feels for us, Master replied after I expressed my gratitude. The Lord responds to all and works for all. Just as he sent rain mightily, so he fulfills any sincere desire of the devotee. Seldom do men realize how often God heeds their prayers. He is not partial to a few, but he listens to everyone who approaches him, trusting him. His children should ever have implicit faith in the loving kindness of their omnipresent Father. Sri Yukteswar sponsored 4 yearly festivals at the equinoxes and solstices, and his disciples gathered from far and near. The winter solstice celebration was held in Serampore. The first one I attended left me with a permanent lesson. The festivities started in the morning with a barefoot procession along the streets. The voices of 100 students rang out with the sweet religious songs. A few musicians played the flute and the kol kartara, drums and cymbals. Enthusiastic townspeople strewed the path with flowers, glad to be summoned from prosaic tasks by a resounding praise of the Lord's blessed name. The long tour ended in the courtyard at the hermitage. There we encircled our guru, while students on upper balconies showered us with marigold blossoms. Many guests went upstairs to receive a pudding of chana and oranges. I made my way to a group of brother disciples who were serving today as cooks. Food for such large gatherings had to be cooked outdoors in huge cauldrons. The improvised wood-burning brick stoves were smoky and tear-provoking, but we laughed merrily at our work. Religious festivals in India are never considered troublesome. Each one does his part, supplying money, rice, vegetables, or his personal services. Master was soon in our midst, supervising the details of the feast, busy every moment. He kept pace with the most energetic young student. A sankirtan, group chanting, accompanied by harmonium and hand-played Indian drums, was in progress on the second floor. Sriyukteswar listened appreciatively. His musical sense was acutely perfect. They are off-key. Master left the cooks and joined the artists. The melody was heard again, this time correctly rendered. In India, music as well as painting and the drama is considered a divine art. Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, the eternal trinity, were the first musicians. The divine dancer, Shiva, is scripturally represented as having worked out the infinite modes of rhythm in his cosmic dance of universal creation, preservation, and dissolution. While Brahma accentuated the time beat with the clanging cymbals, and Vishnu sounded the holy mridanga, or drum. Krishna, an incarnation of Vishnu, is always shown in Hindu art with the flute, on which he plays the enrapturing songs that recalls to their true home the human souls wandering in Maya delusion. Saraswati, goddess of wisdom, is symbolized as performing on the Veena, mother of all stringed instruments. The Samaveda of India contains the world's earliest writings on musical science. The ancient rishis discovered these laws of sound alliance between nature and man. Because nature is an objectification of Om, the primal sound or vibratory ruler, man can obtain control over all natural manifestations through the use of certain mantras or chants. Historical documents tell of the remarkable powers possessed by Mayan Tansen, 16th century court musician for Akbar the Great. Commanded by the emperor to sing a night raga while the sun was overhead, Tansen intoned a mantra which instantly caused the whole palace precincts to become enveloped in darkness. The deeper aim of the early rishi musicians was to blend the singer with the cosmic song, which can be heard through awakening of man's occult spinal centers. Indian music is a subjective, spiritual, and individualistic art, aiming not at symphonic brilliance, but at personal harmony with the oversoul. The Sanskrit word for musician is Bhagavata, he who sings the praises of God. The Sankirtans, or musical gatherings, are an effective form of yoga or spiritual discipline, necessitating deep concentration, intense absorption in the seed thought and sound. Because man himself is an expression of the creative word, sound has the most potent and immediate effect on him, offering a way to remembrance of his divine origin. The Sankirtan, issuing from Sriyukteswar's second story sitting room on the day of the festival, was inspiring to the cooks amidst the steaming pots. My brother disciples and I joyously sang the refrains, beating time with our hands. By sunset, we had served our hundreds of visitors with puri, rice and lentils, vegetable curry, and rice pudding. We laid cotton blankets over the courtyard. Soon the assemblage was squatting under the starry vault, quietly attentive to the wisdom pouring from Sriyukteswar's lips. His public speeches emphasized the value of Kriya Yoga and a life of self-respect, calmness, determination, simple diet, and regular exercise. A group of very young disciples then chanted a few sacred hymns. The meeting concluded with Sankirtan. From 10 o'clock until midnight, the ashram residents washed pots and pans and cleared the courtyard. My guru called me to his side. I'm pleased over your cheerful labors today and during the past week of preparations. I want you with me. You may sleep in my bedroom. This was a privilege I had never thought would fall to my lot. We sat a while in the state of intense divine tranquility. Hardly 10 minutes after we got into bed, Master rose and began to dress. What is the matter, sir? I felt a tinge of unreality in the unexpected joy of sleeping beside my guru. I think that a few students who missed their proper train connections will be here soon. Let us have some food. Guruji, no one would come at 1 o'clock in the morning. You stay in bed. You have been working very hard, but I am going to work and cook. At Chuchiswara's resolute tone, I jumped up and followed him to the small daily used kitchen adjacent to the second story inner balcony. Rice and dal were soon boiling. My guru smiled affectionately. Tonight, you have conquered fatigue and fear of hard work. You shall never be bothered by them in the future. As he uttered these words of lifelong blessing, footsteps sounded in the courtyard. I ran downstairs and admitted a group of students. Dear brother, how reluctant we are to disturb Master at this hour. One man addressed me apologetically. We made a mistake about our train schedules, but felt we could not return home without a glimpse of our guru. He has been expecting you and is even now preparing your food. Sri Yukteswar's welcoming voice rang out. I led the astonished visitors to the kitchen. Master turned to me with twinkling eyes. Now that you have finished comparing notes, no doubt you are satisfied that our guests really did miss their train. I followed him to his bedroom a half hour later, realizing fully that I was about to sleep beside a godlike guru. Privileged we are to have glimpses into Master's life with this guru and his interior experiences that he describes so brilliantly in the autobiography of a yogi. Over these past few days, there have been powerful currents of work. During these changes of the year, this one, the fall equinox, it comes with special times of upliftment. But unless we are like a sailboat with our sail raised and ready, rudder in hand, we cannot catch those currents. They pass us by without a notice. So let us spread our sails. Let us enter into the deep quiet and feel those spiritual currents lifting us higher and higher. At the end of each hour, I will ring a bell, and we will have about 10 minutes, in which time, if you want to get up, use the washroom, get a drink, stretch your legs, you're very welcome to do so. We'll have a break between 12 and 12:30 for a brown bag lunch, and then we will continue on until 4. Let us take time and the opportunity at this blessed time and with this blessed group. Let us feel those uplifting currents. Let us soar high. When I was up in the Himalayas, I watched their eagles. Their wingspans were 6 and 7 feet wide. and up on the plateau where we were at, they would launch themselves and never even flap a wing, and just soar on the currents coming from the valley floor 1,000 feet below. Let us spread our wings. And flap them, making the mind work and work and work. Simply spread them. Catch those uplifting currents.